You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello, I'm joined by Paul Roberts, Executive Director and co-founder of Turnberry Consulting, and Isabel Taylor, Head of Research and Publications at the same organisations. They're both among the three authors of University Trends Contemporary Campus Design, published by Routledge and available now, I think. Is that right?
That's correct.
The book examines a range of directions in which the design of university buildings might be moving. Perhaps I could start by asking why this book is making an appearance now. Is it a particularly interesting time for university campus design?
I think it's fair to say it's university campus design is always at an interesting time. If you look at the history of design over a very long term, you can find lots of dynamic periods, and this period perhaps is quite dynamic given the increase in numbers of people going into higher education. But the GI Bill in the US led to an explosion of numbers of people going into higher education, and there were lots of new campuses built at that time. So not particularly dynamic, but always an interesting time.
And the book sort of focuses on a series of trends. One of them I'll pick out first, adaptive reuse. Sounds a bit of a grand term for sort of repurposing existing buildings to me. Is that the size of it, and is that popular because, well, it's cheaper?
I don't think it's only because it's cheaper. There are a number of reasons. A lot of very historic universities tend to be, may have been built in remote locations 200 years ago, and now are in urban, becoming urban areas, and therefore they are landlocked and they need to use their buildings more carefully. So an example like Berkeley is looking at reusing buildings that perhaps 50 years ago would have been ancillary buildings, but they have little limited land and they wish to do it in that way. In other circumstances, colleges like Savannah College of Art and Design purposely seek to identify older buildings because they think it adds a degree of importance and brand value to what they're trying to do. Mm. And in other circumstances, it's quite clear that reusing in Oxford, the inorganic chemistry laboratories, 1930s buildings, have been refurbished to an excellent standard, which was probably a cheaper solution than building new. So there are different reasons why people refurbish buildings in different ways.
Mm. Berkeley, the example you gave there, are they using an old laundry, is it, for teaching these
days? I think it's a laundry and an admin building and some open space, and if you look at the law faculty at Berkeley now, you would say it was an exemplary building. You wouldn't think it was a reuse.
Mm. Isabel, we were talking just before started recording about campuses that were designed far more specifically for higher education use. So places like the University of East Anglia obviously had a concept taken through to fruition. I mean, is this repurposing, reuse, is it as effective? Is it, are students getting out of that, do you think, what they get out of a campus that's designed specifically for higher education?
I think as long as the designers of the building are versed in what they're doing, have a set specification list to fulfil, then adaptive reuse can bring life and vivacity to a campus and can really invest a place with history, especially to universities and campuses which don't have a long history. For example, the book talks about a boiler house at a campus in Sydney. Mm. It's a relatively new campus, but the university has gone through a process of repurposing the buildings on the existing site. It used to be an asylum at one point. And they've really used these repurposed buildings as a focal point for university life and to give a sense of legacy to this new campus.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one of the other trends that you explore is very different to sort of the reuse of an existing building. Starkitecture is the phrase you use. I mean, when I think of incredible university buildings, I think of places like Durham University's mm. castle and maybe Corpus Christi College at Oxford. But presumably here we're talking about modern buildings that are built, what, deliberately to impress, to get the wow factor?
Well, yeah, I mean, Christopher Wren was a starkitect, I would say, yeah, probably of his day, and he was probably the first major architect to develop buildings at Oxford and Cambridge. And Saarinen built very impressive and successful buildings in his way. So the best architects in the world have always sought to design at the world's leading universities. It is a very, very sort of vibrant environment for them to work within. However, the star architect is a situation where, often driven by a university, there's an aspiration to do something which is beyond the ordinary to grab attention or to demonstrate a sort of a modernity about what that institution wishes to do. You know, the sort of Sydney Opera House sort of example is probably the most extreme example of something changing a whole perception of a city by one building.
Mm.
And people often think that that is the way that universities can be changed and dealt with. So this is a problem that's probably become more, not a problem or an issue that's become more relevant over time. They tend to be quite expensive buildings. Sometimes there's a functional issue. But very, very famous architects have been associated with these for a very long time. But in a world which is, there's greater communication and there's more visual material, some universities think that that is a way to enhance their brand, and therefore it's become more prevalent over time, usually with quite large budgets and sometimes with some disappointments and failures.
So rather than invest in the sort of long-term hard work of improving one's educational reputation, you could perhaps throw some money at the problem, produce an impressive building, and still have the sort of effect of making your university more desirable to students?
There are clearly some universities where that approach is seen to be an effective way to enhance the reputation of the university. I think that's quite clear. And I know of universities where people will say, yes, but the leaders of the university want to pursue that particular approach. That doesn't mean that in some circumstances the outcome of that approach can be wonderful and fantastic and endure for a very long period of time. But sometimes the reason for the decision isn't necessarily about the long-term effective operation of the university. Sometimes there's a different reason.
And do you have any examples of where it's been effective and perhaps where it's not been effective?
I think the Foster buildings at Stanford are a good example of finely designed buildings which are fit for their purpose, yet are impressive and stunning to look at.
Mm.
So that is a good example where an architect has been employed with a local architect to achieve those objectives. There are certain buildings done at Brown University by Raphael Vanoli which are very impressive and at Princeton in what they do, and they very clearly meet the brief and the departmental requirements of what they wish to do. So there are clear examples where very well-known and highly regarded architects have produced schemes of great quality and important functional need. I mean, the classic one that would be criticised by many would be the Sutter Centre at MIT by Geary, which is often cited as an example of a building that perhaps doesn't achieve all those objectives and was reportedly significantly over budget in what happened. So that's not a confirmed position, but it demonstrates the difference between the two.
Absolutely. Is there the examples that you've given are sort of US-based. In my mind's eye, again, I think of big university investment, big money projects. I sort of think of East Asia to a certain extent. Do you notice any global differences in how universities are approaching their sort of design and their approach to building and campus design?
Well, I think in Asia, certainly, we're getting a huge boom in higher education. Countries which have been used to feeding out their students to more established higher education marketplaces are certainly trying to keep hold of their 18-year-olds and are really trying to build up their higher education industry. And you are getting a huge investment into higher education in countries like China and Singapore, and you're getting this creation of new campuses which are designed to from the ground up to really characterize everything that these nations want to achieve through their higher education industry. For example, in Singapore, the Singapore University of Technology and Design, which is being built at the moment, the Singapore government has identified key areas that it wants to focus on, and so it's designing a campus purely to focus on these aspects of industry, so technology and design, and the whole campus is being shaped purely to cater for these disciplines.
I think there's a inherent difficulty which is very understandable for anywhere that's trying to develop higher education at a very rapid pace. What tends to happen is you get very large campuses, you get mega structures where a single concept is delivered very quickly in a short period of time. That was relevant, as I mentioned earlier, in the US and North America in the 1960s where campus, whole campuses, or the UEA example, or Sussex, where whole campuses were built in very short periods of time. The issue with that is if you compare that to someone like the University of Pisa, which is in 78 buildings developed over hundreds of years, which allows it to adapt, grow, evolve, and find the right solutions. The danger of a mega campus built at one time by usually one architectural firm or one person is either they follow the specific sort of teaching methods of that time, or it is very fashionable and becomes unfashionable, or follows one person's ideology which proves to be misplaced. So there's a real danger in very, very significant mega campus development by one firm, in that if it's a mistake, the whole thing is a mistake. Unfortunately, if you wish to expand higher education very quickly, you have relatively few other options. So that's a real challenge for today, to get that balance right, and to avoid the historical nature that has worked so well. Why is it that so many of the Oxbridge-type schemes, or the Chicago UVA-type schemes, which are basically built on a quadrangle and a basic concept, rarely ever develop today? Mainly because architects wish to do things which are different, which are moving things on. And some of the best methods still work the best.
Sure. You mentioned expanding there. One of the other ways to expand is what you term joint venture buildings. I know the only example I can think of is the University of Worcester, which I know shares sort of buildings with local authorities. I must confess I haven't read the book in full. Is that what that particular type of expansion involved? So getting other entities on board?
It might not only be a local authority, it might be other universities, or other universities don't have the critical mass to provide a particular type of facility, a sports facility or a student facility, and coming together to try and do that. I think what occurs in a more dynamic time is greater innovation in solving individual problems. So rather than just saying we can't develop this particular scheme, why don't we look to other universities or other institutions or partners to allow us to develop something that way, and perhaps we will compromise on our exclusive use for the basis of having the facility. Mm-hmm. So in a world of greater competition, you need to do better, and sometimes innovation and different structures means you have to do better. So one of the things that we see throughout the book as a whole now is the typical time of isolated or individual campuses who control all the facilities on one site, some very good, some modest and some poor. There's now greater innovation to go off-site, enter into partnerships, take a different approach to achieve the facilities that are required to remain competitive.
And does that not jeopardise the sort of the original purpose of a university? If you're trying to work with other agencies with their own interests and their own demands on that building, does it lead to an inferior sort of service for students?
I think the argument would be it's better to have a service than no service. Clearly, in the days of greater branding and a sort of greater approach and a more virtual world, I think that university would rather, for example, in terms of leisure or sports facilities, have a shared facility rather than just rely on a private facility, which sometimes might happen. So I think that it might not be a panacea, but it might be something you need to do to remain competitive. Because because there's such available information on relative performance and relative quality facilities, if you are very exposed to your weaknesses, much more than you would have been before. Before, someone might not have realised it was a weakness till they turned up on campus and couldn't find it. Because it wouldn't have been in the prospectus, and they only went to one open day. So it's a different sort of world today. So the competitive nature and the need to innovate to solve the competitive problems is much more important.
Mm-hmm. I suppose to do some of that joint working, you need to be in certain locations. I saw you speaking at the International Festival of Business in Liverpool earlier this year. One of the themes of that talk was urbanism, and maybe the long term for universities to survive, for them to thrive, they need to be in city centres where they have access to things like libraries, things that you don't find if you're suburban or isolated to some extent. That's pretty worrying for a lot of universities, I'd imagine. If you're saying sort of down the line, these sort of out of town campuses might actually struggle to make it work. Is that something that universities need to be wary of?
I think that it is a relative comment in that over the long term, if we take the example of a a 1960s campus university that is in a city of 250,000 people on the outskirts in a suburban location. It has to provide all the needs of its students on that site in a realistic way, or have a very, very good public transport system to city life. And over time, that is much more difficult to sustain, because the expectations of students and the desire of students to travel and interact and do things is much greater. And therefore, the point I was making in Liverpool is it will be relatively easier for city centre universities who have constraints on growth and availability of other buildings and other problems, it will be relatively easier for them to create the more vibrant urban living environment for a student, which will be sought after over the very long term, than more remote campus universities, which were, to some extent, a child of the 1960s. So I think that will be a challenge for those universities. It's interesting that Cornell University, in setting up Cornell Tech in New York City, perceived themselves in some circumstances to be remote, although Cornell is an incredibly highly regarded, famous and excellent university, but quite a few hours from New York City. So they felt that a New York City base was something that was important to them. So these are interesting times on these subjects.
Mm. I noticed the book does refer to online learning, and that's quite an interesting area, isn't it? Because I know I've spoken to a number of vice chancellors who are designing new buildings. I think Southampton leaps to mind. I spoke to the VC at Northampton as well, Nick Petford. He told me they're building a brand new campus on the riverside up there, and we sort of jokingly suggested maybe lecture theatres wouldn't be required as more of that sort of teaching goes online. I mean, I sort of hesitate to use the MOOC word, but I mean, as more and more sort of lecture type learning is available online, that must impact on the sort of trends that we see in the way university buildings are designed.
I think definitely you're right in saying that. I think I'm not wrong in saying that there's a definite trend declining the number of dedicated lecture theatres that are being built. The library that the student of the 1950s knew is very different to the library that students of today know. Online learning is transforming the spaces that universities are building, but I don't necessarily think that means that they're going to stop building. Conversely, I think it's going to encourage universities to be more innovative in the type of spaces that it does build. We can see that definitely in the type of libraries and the type of learning spaces that are being built at the moment. There's a chapter in the book about what we call hub buildings. And it discusses the recent trend for these sort of focal points on campuses. Often they're called 24-hour stops. They comprise informal learning spaces, social spaces, IT facilities, dining, counselling.
A one-stop shop for all your
exactly
student needs.
This is a real reflection of the sort of high-wired environment that students are expecting these days.
Mm-hmm. And I think that in those spaces, faculty will be happy to talk to students in those spaces rather than have an office, and the students will meet in groups in those spaces, and they will become, I think, particularly in the UK, the advent of student fees, and in other parts of the world, the financial pressures mean that this is what students require. This is the environment in which they feel comfortable. And again, going back to the issue of competition, particularly in the UK, unless universities are able to provide that in a time of student fees, then they will become uncompetitive. The idea that a student union will be sometimes the most modest and poorestly specified building on a campus, I think those days are long gone. Mm. So I think this is a subtle change. I think we'll see fewer lecture theatres built, and we'll see fewer faculty buildings built for faculty offices, but the idea of community and learning together, eating, sleeping and recreating, that's not going to change, and that's more what universities will focus on And less on fixed lecture theatres.
Mm. I mean, Association of University Directors of Estates figures just this week actually showed, I think, a 9% increase it was overall in spending on non-residential estates.
Yep.
So, I mean, I suppose that reflects exactly what
yes.
you're saying there, which is students, students are king now, aren't they? They're the ones who are paying, so you have to give them what they need.
Exactly, yes. And whilst league tables have become very prevalent, student satisfaction is now also very relevant. And, you know, a very poor student satisfaction report in any shape or form will suddenly lead to a significant drop-off in student applications and therefore financial position for the university. So all of a sudden there's a very significant transparency about the quality of facilities at the university that historically just didn't exist.
Paul Roberts, Isabel Taylor, thank you very much for speaking to me.
Pleasure.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.